All right, well, good. I guess it's still the morning. Everyone, my name's Ethan, for y'all who don't know me. It's my wife right there, Jen. My grandparents who came out, super grateful they're here. And today we're gonna be talking about your vision. I was talking to D. Isaac and Anthony earlier before this started, and another way you can talk about your vision for life is your aim in life. Like, what are you aiming at? So I hope that's kind of the context in this passage. And I hope you guys enjoyed the passage. I know it was a little bit longer today, but I feel like there's actually so many correlations between what Jonathan and his armor bearer were doing and what we do today as followers of Jesus. I know it's a little bit different now with the new covenant, but there's a lot we can pull from it. So I pray Jesus gives us the eyes to see that. To start off, I want to share a story of another job that I have that some of you guys might not know about, is I actually coach missionaries in support raising. So let's say there's someone that wants to go to Africa or the Middle East or something. I'll talk to them and ask them, what's your vision? When you approach people to financially partner with you, they don't really want to give because they're like, oh, I get to pay for your laundry. You know, like, that's not really compelling vision. The vision is, oh, I want to see like transformation come to this country. In this country, women are treated so poorly, but I want to see Jesus come and saturate this area so that what we say, there's no place left. Like, there's transformation in the community. And that is more compelling. That's what people want to give to. And I think ultimately that's what we all want to aim for in life. But what I've noticed as I coach people in support raising, and I'm actually partially support raised as well, so I've gone through it, is it starts off grandiose, amazing, right? We're going to reach all of LA. We're going to reach the whole nation. And then some people you think are going to give, they don't give. Maybe the timeline is slower than you expect. And I think that relates to us a lot as followers of Jesus, as disciple makers. Maybe we're not as far in our growth as we want to be with God. Maybe we've tried sharing the gospel. We've tried starting Bible studies with friends and family. And maybe you've asked to pray for someone and they just keep rejecting you. And then they finally accept your prayer. And they cry and they say yes to Jesus, and then you never see them again. And I share these stories because we've experienced them. I know a lot of us have. I think my encouragement to all of us is, it's not always about, oh, I got to keep, you know, being a better gospel presenter. Or I got to keep, like, going to the Bible. And I encourage, yes, do all those things. But my prayer for all of us is that we cling to the vision. It's not down here. It's what has God called us to, and are we willing to do whatever it takes? But I think it's easy for us to start focusing on the little things, what's going wrong. So let's get back to the story now. I want to paint some context of what's going on. Before this scene we read about in 1 Samuel 14, 1-23, Israel is clearly in a war against the Philistines. Saul was their first king, the Jewish people. He's crowned king. He sees some success in military victories. And then, because he's seeing success against the Philistines respond. And the text right before this says that the Philistines had so many troops, their numbers were as many sand in the seashore. So basically, it's like endless. Imagine like sand in the seashore. That's how it felt with them. And Saul is supposed to wait 7 days on God before he responds. So imagine that. He sees the military coming, all the people swarming around him. He starts with 3,000 men. And then, as the days go, he's waiting on God. His army shrinks from 3,000 to 600. And on the seventh day, if he waited just like a few hours more, God would have, who knows what God would have done. But instead of waiting on God, he took matters into his own hands. And God actually rejects him as king. So that's kind of what's going on. Their human king is broken. And now we're going to get into the passage. And one more thing I forgot to mention. Nobody has weapons. They literally had no weapons, it says in the text before this. Only Saul and Jonathan have swords. Everyone else has, like, imagine like a plow or like a farm tool. So that's the context. It seems pretty bleak. let's read the first passage now, the first section. So verses 1 through 5 say, "One day, Jonathan said to his armor bearer, 'Come on, let's go over to where the Philistines have their outpost.' But Jonathan did not tell his father what he was doing. Meanwhile, Saul and his 600 men were camped on the outskirts of Gibeah, around the pomegranate tree at Migron. Among Saul's men was Ahijah, the priest, who was wearing the ephod, the priestly vest. Ahijah was the son of Ichabod's brother, Ahitub, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord who had served at Shiloh. No one realized that Jonathan had left the Israelite camp. To reach the Philistine outpost, Jonathan had to go down between two rocky cliffs that were called Bozez and Seneh. The cliff on the north was in front of Michmash, and the one on the south was in front of Geba." So to start off, Jonathan essentially turns to his armor bearer, and he's like, "Let's take a leap of faith." There was no clear command or anything. It was just, "Let's take a leap of faith." And then you also see Saul in this passage, sitting under a pomegranate tree, kind of more passive. So as we read this text, I also want you guys to notice Jonathan and kind of see how he compares to Saul. So I think for all of us, there's parts of us that can relate to Jonathan, there's parts of us that can relate to Saul, and even to the armor bearer and other people in the story. Something I noticed about Saul was, even though he technically was the official king and the public figure, from his actions, you can kind of see that he's pretty afraid. Meanwhile, Jonathan, he's confident, but he's secret about it. And I think that can relate to us in the sense that I think in public, sometimes we think like, oh, do we want to live for the crowd? We see what's going on, but actually, how do we feel internally? You can be in public and be totally afraid. Meanwhile, you could also be like Jonathan, acting in secret, basically acting only where God sees you and you see fruit. So the question I like to think about is, which one do we kind of lean towards? Do we do the same things in public that we do in secret, or do we only do them in public? Next, we see that Jonathan, as armor bearer, must go through these two. There's a lot of names in this passage, but one of the cliffs. So imagine they're on this cliff on one side. This is where the Israelite camp is. There's a cliff, and they have to go through this narrow passage, and then there's another cliff where the outpost is. One of the cliffs means slippery slope, and the other means thorns. So even though they're taking this step of faith, they're going with, honestly, a lot would probably say a foolish, they're going to their death, is probably what a lot of people would think. They're stepping away from comfort of the crowd. They have to go through this narrow pass that's slippery and thorny to get to their enemy. I think sometimes we want to wait on God and be like, God, why aren't you moving? You know, what are you doing? Like, you're not answering my prayer. But God's actually inviting us to go through the slippery places, through the thorny places, using our hands and feet to see victory. Acts 14:22 says, we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. I hope that can encourage us in the sense that if you're going through hardships, it doesn't mean God's mad at you. It's actually an opportunity to submit to Him. And if you can embrace that process, you're going to come out better on the other side. For me, something that I started doing in college, and Anthony shared about his first time sharing the gospel. But for me, one of the big moments was when I was in college, and a mentor at the time named Sean was like, Ethan, do you want to go pray around your college campus? And I was like, that seems like a godly thing to do. So sure, I'll go join you tomorrow or whatever. Well, that night, I'll be honest, you guys, I did not sleep. I was nervous. I was like, why am I getting all nervous? And then deep down, if I'm being honest, I was like, I hope I don't see someone I know. You know, that'd be really awkward, right? So we show up. Sean does all the talking for an hour. I do all the walking and standing there quietly, awkwardly. And at the end of this hour, Sean's like, so same time next week? And I was like, oh no, he got me. I'm free at this time every week. And I kept taking that step. And eventually, over the course of some time, by the end of college, my friend Eric and I found ourselves at this frat party, intentionally going to just try to love people and share Jesus with them. And that was a crazy time. But my encouragement to us is, just say yes. Jonathan's armor bearer said yes. We obviously read the whole passage right now, so we know what happens in the end. But you never know what your one yes can lead to. Next, I want to read verses 6 through 7, which highlights we can all be an armor bearer. It says, "Let's go across to the outpost of those pagans." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Perhaps the Lord will help us, for nothing can hinder the Lord. He can win a battle whether he has many warriors or only a few." "Do what you think is best," the armor replied. "I'm with you completely, whatever you decide." So Jonathan here is fearless, and his armor bearer, without a sword, just trusts him completely. I think often when we think of Jonathan, right, we think of he was like a really good friend to David, right? Like him and David made this like heart covenant thing, and that's beautiful, that's amazing. But what I don't think we realize is, who was that first friend to Jonathan? And here we see it was the armor bearer. The armor bearer actually is the slept on character in the biblical narrative. The one who doesn't even have a name. He's just Jonathan's armor bearer. But he's the one that I think actually modeled true friendship to Jonathan, who then Jonathan received that and was able to model that to David. A common analogy I've heard from people in our disciple-making relationships is we want to go from a triangle to a round table. So whenever you start pouring into someone, there might be a teacher at first. So that makes sense. There's a teacher and they got two apprentices or two people following them. But we don't want to keep it like that. We actually want to go to a round table as quickly as possible, because that's what Jesus did. Jesus, he was a teacher to his disciples, but then he knew he was leaving. He washed his disciples' feet, and then they washed other people they poured into, who eventually, by God's grace, has led to us today. So even though we might be reading this and be like, "Jonathan's crazy, I can never be a Jonathan," we can all be an armor bearer. We can all get next to someone, wash their feet in the name of Jesus, so that love multiplies generationally. Next, we're going to read verses 8 through 15. And I think this section highlights that God actually wants to use you. He wants to use all of us. So it says, "All right then," Jonathan told him, "we will cross over and let them see us. If they say to us, 'Stay where you are or we'll kill you,' then we'll stop and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come on up and fight,' then we will go up. That will be the Lord's sign that he will help us defeat them." When the Philistines saw them coming, they shouted, "Look, the Hebrews are crawling out of their holes." Then the men from the outpost shouted to Jonathan, "Come on up here and we'll teach you a lesson." "Come on, climb up right behind me," Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "for the Lord will help us defeat them." So they climbed up using both hands and feet, and the Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed those who came behind him. They killed some 20 men in all, and their bodies are scattered over about half an acre. Suddenly, a panic broke out in the Philistine army, both in the camp and in the field, including even the outposts and raiding parties. And just then, an earthquake struck, and everyone was terrified. So in these big decisions, what did Jonathan do? He didn't just show himself and, "God's going to help me for sure." He actually used some discernment. He's like, "I'm going to wait on the Lord for guidance." I think a key thing to note for context here is that in the Old Testament, in this section, God had already kind of shown to him, or the Israelites, that he was going to free them from their captivity from the Philistines. So if you're an Israelite at the time, you know that it's God's will actually to deliver you from the enemies that are around you. So a takeaway I think we can take is God, maybe not every time, but he's going to empower us to do his will. Often I hear the question, "What is God's will for my life?" And I actually think a lot of people have a very narrow view of this. I think God's will for most people is like a bar. It's like, who should I marry? What job should I get? And then below this bar, it's like, love my neighbor, love people. And we make a big deal out of these ones. But when our neighbor's trash can falls over or whatever, or someone's going through a hard time, we just kind of walk. It's like optional. When it's actually flipped, these ones are commanded, and these other ones, they're gray. They're not as clear in the scripture. Often I think we project God onto our dreams, instead of putting our dreams in submission to God. Another thing that I think is a misconception with God's will is sometimes even really good-hearted is like, I'm going to do this ministry for God in this country, in this way, at this time. And it's really absolute. And I think there's good intention there. Like, definitely be bold in what you feel like God's calling you to do. But I love how our friend James said it, as Anthony mentioned last week, the guy who was a missionary in Japan. He says, he's a missionary in Japan, for context, if you guys don't know who James is. And people ask him, so why do you feel called to Japan? And he's like, well, Jesus tells us to make disciples of all nations. Japan is unreached, which means many of them have never heard about the name of Jesus and don't even know someone that knows Jesus, for context. And he's like, Japan is just seems like a strategic place to start. That way, if I get kicked out one day or I can't go back for whatever reason, I could still make disciples in other unreached places or among my friends and family. So may that also be our view of God's will. I think a way we can kind of position ourselves to receive more of his power as we do his will is to set our sails for God. So think of a boat, and a sailboat for that matter. We can set our sails, do all the right things. It doesn't mean that the wind is going to perfectly blow the direction we want. But when it does, when God's spirit comes, we're ready. Because we have already done the things we need to do that are clear. And we're trusting God with things that are not as clear. The last thing I want to highlight, at least from this section, is did you see the armor bearer killed those that came behind Jonathan? I think the saying goes, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go farther, go together. Jonathan needed his armor bearer there. I think sometimes we want to jump in, go alone. When you have that person that's committed to you, as Jesus says, the pair that you're supposed to be sent out in from Luke 10, there's something powerful about that. So as we go, try to take people. Let's now move to verses 16 through 20 as we get towards the end here. This section's kind of hard for me because we see Saul. So Saul's lookouts in Gibeah of Benjamin saw a strange sight. The vast army, remember, it was like sand on a seashore. So the vast army of the Philistines began to melt away in every direction. Call the roll and find out who's missing, Saul ordered. And when they checked, they found that Jonathan and his armor bearer were gone. Then Saul shouted to Ahijah, bring the ephod here. For at that time, Ahijah was wearing the ephod in front of the Israelites. But while Saul was talking to the priest, the confusion in the Philistine camp grew louder and louder. So Saul said to the priest, never mind, let's get going. Then Saul and all his men rushed out to the battle and found the Philistines killing each other. There was terrible confusion everywhere. So imagine you're Saul sitting on this outpost and you're surrounded by what's supposed to be sand on a seashore of enemies. And they start just melting away. So then he's like, Ahijah, which is the guy that was the representative to God at the time. Let's seek God, essentially, is what they were doing. And instead of waiting on God's will, what does he do? The confusion gets loud, and he just rushes into battle. And the interesting part about that is the Philistines were killing each other. So even if he didn't rush into that battle, they would have been okay. As I share this and as I was reading this, it's kind of funny because you see Jonathan step out really boldly, but then you see also like Saul rush in. So there's ways you can like step out boldly, but do it well. And there's ways you can rush and not do it well. And I think there's two extremes, right? We can be hasty like Saul, which we don't want to do. Or we can be waiting as Saul was in the beginning, waiting under the pomegranate tree when you should be leading the people, fighting and courageous. So like traffic, if you drive too fast in traffic, you're going to crash, right? You're going to hit someone. If you drive too slow, you're also going to disrupt traffic because people are going to honk at you, be mad at you, and whatnot. I think for us, we want to find that balance of doing God's will, waiting on him, but going at his pace instead of our own. Something cool we can see too that relates to our harvest work is even though Saul rushed, he did do something right. He went where God was already at work. Last week we studied Luke 10, find a person of peace, someone already hungry for God. For us, as we discern the Lord's will, start with where God's already working in your life. Where do you already have Christian friends you can start praying with? There's already someone that's spiritually hungry in your family to do discipleship with. Go with where he's at work. Now, this last section, we're going to see the few turn into the many. So even the Hebrews, who had previously gone over to the Philistine army, revolted and joined in with Saul, Jonathan, and the rest of the Israelites. Likewise, the men of Israel who were hiding in the hill country of Ephraim joined the chase when they saw the Philistines running away. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle continued to rage even beyond Beth-Aven. So at first it was just Jonathan and his armor bearer. And then we see Saul and his army. And then we see actually people that defected to the other side. So the rebels that were Israelites that joined in with the enemy. They come back to Israel and fight for Israel. And at the end we see those who were hiding in caves and that were scared. They join the battle. As we get activated in sharing the gospel and making disciples, I think often we can get discouraged because we feel like Jonathan is armor bearer. I'm starting to do a DBS, or I'm going back to church, or I'm doing these spiritual things, and I'm crazy. No one else is coming with me. They're just staying behind. But we see there's a progression. As we step out in God's perfect timing, the second group, Saul and his army, maybe that's friends and family who are not interested right now, they might see the fruit, and they might want to join. And then maybe those betrayers, or maybe the haters in your life who are like, that's never going to work. Eventually, by God's grace, they might see and be like, whoa, we need to join you. And at the end, those who are super afraid, like, I can never share my testimony, they might gain confidence. So it might take time, but we see that God can do it in his perfect timing. And that's how the passage ends, too. The Lord rescued Israel that day. It wasn't Jonathan, it wasn't the armor bearer. Victory was God's. And victory belonged just as much to that defector that it did to Jonathan or anyone else, because it was God who was working through broken people to do extraordinary things. So whether we are the ones that step out first, or we maybe are in the second group or in the third group or fourth group, the question I want to ask us is, how involved do you want to be? Another way to look at it is, imagine you're at a concert and you see a crazy person dancing. And they're dancing alone. They look crazy. Like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, whoa, that guy's really weird over there. But then eventually another crazy person comes. There's two of them now. Maybe for like 5 minutes, it's just two of them. And then eventually 10 minutes pass, and a third and a fourth. But then eventually the floodgates open, and what started as a few turns into many. I pray all of us can be that crazy dancing guy. Love Jesus so much, love making disciples, doing his will, and in God's timing, this whole area will be saturated. Those friends, those family that you thought were never going to be touched with the gospel will be touched. There's a YouTube video on that. If you guys want to like watch it, let me know and I'll send it to you. It's a cool video. To take this all home, I want to go back to that first question. What is your vision? I know hearing this, it can be like, I just need to go into war, or I need to just wait, or whatever. But I want to take an even bigger step back. What is your aim in life? Jonathan knew that nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. In his eyes, if you think about it, it wasn't just on himself. If he just wanted to save himself, he could have hid and ran away from battle. But he was clinging to a promise that was for all of Israel. So he knew just a little seed of faith, and God blessed it. When I started sharing the gospel more, personally, it was just with college students, because I was a college student. Then I graduated, I started substitute teaching, and then I was like, how can I try to insert Jesus into the classroom in an appropriate manner, or with people I played basketball with at the park? And then one day as I was on a plane and pressing into this, God gave me an image for like all of LA County, which is 10 million people. And I was like, that's you, God, because that's not for me. I would never think about that. I'm only thinking my limited human vision, but God has greater plans. And through his timing, we've connected with Enrich and so many other amazing individuals that we never knew had the same vision, because it's God's vision. So in a moment, I want you to all to journal your current vision in life. I know it's a super big question, but what is your aim in life? Most people, if you ask them this question, they don't know, and that's okay. You may not know. If you don't know what your vision is, what do you spend yourself doing the most? If you spend all your time at work and at the gym and, I don't know, with your family, I could say you value fitness, you value maybe money and comfort for work, and maybe you value your family. That's gonna be, that kind of reveals your values and what you're pursuing in life. And then I wanna challenge you and ask, if that is you, what do you want it to be? And as you think about what you want it to be, ask another question. Is that a God-sized vision? Is that a $1 million vision? Jesus used these two men to defeat an entire army. If you can confidently say, I would invest $1 million into that vision, then I'd be like, that's a God-sized vision. Maybe this is still very like high level and confusing. So let's look at Jesus. What was his vision? What was his aim in life? And one quick way I like to tell people that is the three F's. Jesus often would talk about first his Father in heaven. It was doing his Father's will, as you see in the Lord's Prayer. And then he also said doing his Father's will is his food. He says, that's what I'm doing. It's food to me to do godly things. And then he said that those who do the Father's will are his brothers, his sisters, his mothers, it's his family. So as we close, I want you to take a moment to write down what you think you've currently been aiming at in life, your current vision. And then take another moment to write down what you want your vision to be. And this might not be quick enough time to fully do that. So as we always do, what's the one step you can take to obey? And what's the one step you can take to share with someone who needs to hear this as well? So I'll give you a minute to write down your action item, someone you want to share with, and then I'll wrap us up at the end with a prayer.